This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Do a little something, because it ain't going to happen without some help.
I like that. That's very good.
It's a lot of turducken.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, online and at fordhaminstitute.org. Now join me in welcoming our special guest for this week, Kim Marshall. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Greetings.
Yes. Also joining us, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, David. So for those of you that don't know, but you should, Kim is the author of the Marshall Memo. This is a must read in education. It's almost though a secret society. People that get the Marshall Memo, I had to find out about it secondhand, third hand. But once you're in the loop, it is very exciting. Kim, so start by telling us about the Marshall Memo very briefly. What is it that you send out to folks, to your subscribers, once a week?
So when I finished being a principal, a Boston principal in 2002, I realized that I had time to read, which I did not have as a principal. So I started subscribing to a bunch of publications, now 60 different publications. And every Sunday, I sit down and read through and try to find the articles, the research, the stories that are most interesting and helpful for leaders and teachers. And then on Monday, I sit down and write a précis of each one. It takes about 11 hours. My wife comes home, helps me proofread, cleans it up. And then I send it out to now subscribers in 50 states and 71 foreign countries.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's so great. Well, we are going to talk about a great offshoot of the Marshall Memo, a new book by Kim. Let's cover that in Ed Reform Update. Okay, Kim, so you have a book out called The Best of the Marshall Memo, written by you and a colleague, Jen David Lang. It says, Book One, Ideas and Action Steps to Energize Leadership, Teaching, and Learning. Congrats on the publication. So it gives us an excuse to talk about one of my favorite subjects, Kim, because a subject that I feel like is the hardest one in education, and I've never gotten a great answer to. So now your job is to give us a better answer, which is, how is it that we can do a better job getting research and let's call them best practices to actually be used in our schools? You know, I mean, this seems to be the purpose. You're trying to share the best that you're reading with other folks, especially folks in the schools, practitioners. Why is it so hard, Kim, do you think, in education, in American education, for us to simply do things that work?
Well, the number one problem is the one that I had as a principal for 15 years, which is simply not having the time to read. The second problem is that the good ideas, as I discovered each week, or as I do discover each week at the Marshall Memo, is they're very spread out. I mean, there might be a wonderful idea in the Harvard Education Review. There might be a great idea in the New York Times. There might be a good piece in CAPA, Educational Leadership. But I subscribe to 60 publications, and routinely I find articles in the most out-of-the-way places, and nobody has the time to do what I do each Sunday, which is sit down for 8 hours and read through this stack of stuff. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that people ignore stuff that they don't agree with. So for example, there's lots of research on not retaining kids in grade, lots of research on the inadequacy of suspensions to fix student behavior, but people keep doing those things because they seem intuitively right.
Boy, you picked two that are going to give us a hard time here, Kim, in some respects. But okay, fair enough. I'm tempted to launch into debate, especially on suspensions, but okay, but I won't. You raise a good point, though, is that we disagree with things and we find things we disagree with, or we end up having fights over, you know, the methodology or the questions that are asked. So, for example, let's take suspensions. We are pretty sure that suspensions don't do a whole lot to help the kid who is suspended. Separate question is whether it might, though, allow for you to have, in some cases, a classroom environment that can get more teaching and learning done. Maybe you don't need to send the kid home, but you need the kid to send the kid somewhere so that you can get back to business. Those are two different questions, right? That's why when we just say, well, let's just do what works, it of course is much more nuanced than that.
And also, what works is pretty complex. I mean, restorative justice, making that work effectively, is complicated. The New York City schools, where I do a lot of work in my coaching, are having a real struggle, you know, making that, training people to make it work effectively. So I totally agree on you know, the learning environment is absolutely essential. My daughter is a seventh grade teacher in Boston, and she does not want kids in her class who are disrupting learning. You know, the teacher's immediate instinct is, you know, let's get these kids to a place where they can get some help. But do they get help when they could just go home? But that's just one of many debates. Speaking of my daughter's school, by the way, they start at 7:15 in the morning. Now, there's another little bit of research that's come out of Minnesota and elsewhere. It's pretty darn clear that high school should not be starting before 8:30 in the morning. So how does that happen?
All right. So you've talked about, first of all, people don't have access to the information. Wasn't that something that we were going to fix with the What Works Clearinghouse? I mean, this seems like a solvable problem that we have this thing called the internet. You know, you've been helping to solve this problem, Kim, with your memo. There's the What Works Clearinghouse. Is it simply that, again, there's ideology and then there's constraints? So you mentioned starting school early. Well, then you get into how is that going to affect parent schedules and how is that going to affect the sports and what about the buses? And we've got this big structure where, you know, maybe at the end of the day, evidence and what works is not the only consideration that happens. I'm talking myself in circles here a little bit. Let me ask you this, Kim. You've been in this field for some time. I'm curious, do you think that the accountability movement, you know, when it came along and said, we're really going to focus on results, we're going to hold people accountable, one hope was it would encourage principals like you to feel more encouraged to go look and find out what works and to do it. Did that help at all?
You're actually talking to the right person there. I was a principal in Boston in 1998 when Boston or Massachusetts introduced standards, the MCAS, a high stakes test for, and I was able to say to my colleagues, if our kids don't get with it, don't get with these standards that have been promulgated here, and they were excellently written and transparent standards, our kids will not get a high school diploma. That sure got our attention. And I was a principal who really used that to work backwards from the fifth grade standards we had to fourth grade, third grade, second grade, first grade, and kindergarten, and actually make very clear, which we had not had up to that point, exactly what kids need to know and be able to do at each grade level. And that turned our school around. It was absolutely transformational. And I think it happened across Massachusetts, which is why Massachusetts is, with a few key exceptions in certain cities and schools, is a nationwide leader. We got the standards right. We got the tests right. People took them seriously. We survived a court challenge. And, and here we are.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. David?
I guess my question is, have we even framed the question, right, Mike? I mean, I think it's clear from this conversation, right? Like even determining what works is challenging and there's no consensus. I guess my question is the right question, how can we get principals to do things that actually work or that seem to work? Or is it, how can we create the conditions where they can do what seems to be working to them? Right. So, I mean, I guess I'd be interested in your reaction to that. I mean, do we have research that is actually going to help people who are in a very specific situation with a particular group of kids? I mean, to what extent can research ever really move the average school leader beyond what they're seeing right in front of them? Does that make sense?
Well, that's a great question. So let's take one of the clearest research findings of the last 20 years, which is that formative on-the-spot assessments in classrooms with teachers seeing what's learned and what's not learned in the moment, like during the actual lesson, and right, fixing learning problems in real time, that makes an enormous difference. It's what good teachers have done back to the days of Socrates. And so this is a very clear research finding. So then you get to the question of how does the principal, let's assume the principal hears that loud and clear. You know, they read articles in the Gadfly or the Marshall Memo or some other place, and they know that. But then they're shackled by a teacher evaluation process that has them hardly ever in classrooms. Or when they're in classrooms, the principals, the teacher's putting on a really good show for them in which they do their formative assessments and their exit tickets. And so the principal is not seeing what happens on a day-by-day basis and is therefore not in a position to coach, cajole, kick butt, whatever it is to get teachers to change from ineffective practices, like asking any questions, you know, and then only calling on the kids who raise their hands versus actually using effective methods of checking for understanding. So there's an example of where we know what works. The principals heard it. We're assuming they've heard it loud and clear, and they're not executing because ineffective teacher evaluation processes.
That's interesting. And you're saying processes that are outside the control of the principal. That in many cases, right, these were handed
unless
down.
The principal is like me, is kind of a mavericky maverick who decides to do more frequent, short, unannounced classroom visits, coach tea. And there are a lot of principals out there who are doing that. But I was just last week working with a group of educators in Connecticut, 90 superintendents and principals and union leaders who just really felt shackled by this statewide policies. The good news is there's a new commissioner who may actually be about to make some kind of changes in that regard. But it took 6 hours for me to sort of talk that one through with them.
Do you see this playing out differently than in charter schools where we at least tried to unshackle educators? That was one of the ideas with charters?
Yes, to some degree. And I am an admirer of certain charter leaders who are doing an absolutely fantastic job. I'm working with a principal in Bedford-Stuyvesant and a mom and pop charter school, Nick Tashuk, who is using effective teacher eval processes, getting the PLC process working effectively, just really running a 700-student school in an effective way. Then I hear about really benighted practices in some charter schools. I mean, you and the Gadfly have written about the no excuses issues and how some are backing away from that. I think one of the most destructive policies I've heard about is in certain New York City schools where principals routinely interrupt teachers during instruction and correct them in front of their students. Now, that to me is a shocking process, and it may explain why half the teachers in those schools are leaving every year. Just the sheer disrespect of teachers and the sheer, bordering on abuse of teachers.
So one last question, Kim. You know, when I've been thinking about this, how do we get better practices to spread? You know, I think about, okay, in other fields, one way that happens is through tools. That can be technology. It can be curriculum. You know, I think about, for example, we've been looking here at Fordham about how we do our own staff evaluation every year. And, you know, you can read the research on it and try to implement it. That's one way. Another way is now there's companies that will sell you, you know, some kind of software that helps you do your staff evaluations. And they say, we've baked the research into it, which is kind of interesting. That takes it a step further, maybe. Do you see that in your work, that there are some tools, technologies, curricula that make all of this easier? Like, for example, a better teacher evaluation program that embeds the good research in it?
That's some of the worst work I've seen. Now, they're clever little iPad programs that principals can take into classrooms and tap out ratings in real time. You know, this is all well-intentioned and very clever, but I find those are the least effective. The most effective are low-tech and high personal. And by the way, isn't it true that most companies and corporations are shifting away from big stakes end-of-the-year evaluations to sort of much more frequent, project-oriented, project-based more to the coaching end of the spectrum than the other end of the spectrum. By the way, I among the educators I was working in New York City last week in District 79 schools, one of the principals rolled off his quote, and I wrote it down for me: "Let me be your coach. Don't make me be your boss."
Oh wow, that's
isn't
great.
Isn't that lovely?
Interesting.
I mean,
interesting.
Coaching on the spot work with teachers, with principals, with superintendents, all that's the real work. When push comes to shove, and the person is demonstrably and persistently ineffective, then you have to shift gears and move to a more formal process. But I think a lot of wise people are shifting much more toward the coaching end of the spectrum. You know, frequent classroom visits. One of the things I preach for superintendents is every time you visit a school, take off your jacket and visit a couple of classrooms with the principal. Look over their shoulder. Go back to the office and debrief with the principal. Get a sense, do they have the skills to observe? How would they talk to the teacher, role-playing? That's the real guts of it. Because I think the biggest moral issue in schools is not horrible teaching. There's very little of that. It's mediocre practices. And I have a whole list of mediocre practices that I talk about all the time. And people nod and laugh. And you know, they get that this is the issue. But how do you change mediocre practices? You don't change them with a 2x4. You change them by getting into classrooms frequently in a low stakes kind of way, talking to the teacher face to face, no electronic communication, face to face coaching, and then maybe a brief electronic follow up. So we're using our technology where it's best, but we're using our human skills where it really makes a difference.
Wow. Well, we will leave it there. So well said, Kim. Really appreciate it. Again, Kim Marshall, author of the weekly Marshall Memo and the latest, the best of the Marshall Memo book. Really appreciate you joining us. And hey, we are always tickled when you include something from Education Gadfly in the Marshall Memo. That's when we know we've made it.
That is one of my favorite reads. You all have a terrific group of writers there, and I always enjoy reading it. I read it faithfully every week and often include good articles.
Thanks a lot, Kim. All right, now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
I understand you got a big Thanksgiving coming.
Ooh, it is a big group. 19. Oof,
amazing.
Scary.
At your house.
At my house, I have a setup team, a pack-up team, and a cleanup team, because everybody's got to do a little something, because it ain't going to happen without some help.
I like that. That's very good.
That's a lot of turducken. Yeah.
That's a lot. I was going to say, are you going to try to keep the cleanup team from drinking too much throughout the day?
Well, there is a bartending team that's also of two people, and they're in charge of topping off the sangria all night.
Is that right?
So, yeah, they'll be happy by then,
whatever
I think.
It takes.
Good things.
Whatever it takes.
Yeah.
All right. What you got for us for this special holiday edition?
Special holiday edition. We've got a new study out in AEFP. You know, we love the AEFP.
Ooh, yeah.
Looks at the impact of providing performance-based scholarships to high school seniors. Specifically, this one's a little different, how those scholarships impact the kids' level of effort and how they choose to spend their time once they're enrolled in college. Analysts use data from the California Performance-Based Scholarship Demonstration Program. This program requires that random assignment take place in the spring of the participant's senior year of high school, and students can use the scholarship in any accredited institution. Be eligible for the study, they have to be seniors, they have to meet the low-income eligibility standard, whatever that is. They have to attend a cash for college workshop where they get help on their FAFSA, their financial aid form. They have to submit their financial aid form, and they have to sign a consent form. So non-merit based. Okay. Randomization occurred within each workshop over 2 years. The scholarship incentive varied in length from 1 to 4 semesters, and it varied in size from about $1,000 to $4,000. Mm-hmm. And then they also varied whether there was a performance required attached to it. So whether you had to maintain a grade of C. The scholarships were paid directly to the students. Another little tidbit. And just, I was thinking like, how does this match up to the Pell Grant? And the Pell Grant award was about $5,300 per year during the same time mm-hmm. of this study. Okay. And here you've got a max of $4,000. All right. About 5,100 students were in the study, about 1,700 in the treatment group with the scholarships, 3,400 in the control group without. And then they had to fill out a bunch of survey stuff, just asking like, what did you do? How do you spend your time while you're in college? Because most of them did, in fact, attend college. I'll get to that. And how they were motivated to learn, so on and so forth. Key finding, treatment group was 5.2 percentage points more likely than the control group to report ever enrolling in the post-secondary institution. They also report studying about 8 minutes more per day. They are once you're in college. Okay. Yes. They were 7.3 percentage points more likely to have been prepared for class in the last 7 days. And they're 6.7 percentage points more likely to attend all their classes in the last week. And then they get into some more stuff. They say the financial incentives induce students to devote more time and effort to their educational activities and less time on, quote, nights out for fun. Okay. And keep in mind that this is self-reported data. So like they know they got the money. So there could obviously be some incentive for them to report likewise. They also find that the scholarship program primarily affects behavior in the semester in which the student is eligible for the funds. Incentives do not generate impacts after the eligibility ends, nor do they increase students' interest or enjoyment in learning. So there's all these non-cognitive things they're looking at. But there were also no negative impacts once the incentive went bye-bye. And there was no lasting change in behavior as a result of prior eligibility on all those different things. I'm getting to the end. They have some evidence that suggests students are motivated by the performance-based component, like you have to keep a C. More so than they would by a simple monetary award with no strings attached. Mm-hmm. Finally, they don't find the differences in responses between students who receive the lower and the higher scholarship, which they were kind of confused about that. And they don't know why. But I was trying to think, well, $500 and $1,000 per semester, $1,000, $4,000. I don't know. You had to think like, well, like how much of a difference would it make? And then I was just curious because I'm like, what else have they done? Because I knew it was just one part of a larger study because it's an MDRC study and they got gazillion dollars. So another study actually did look at the data and found that the kids were, they tracked them for longer and they found that the kids were more likely to matriculate. They did look at the academic piece of this too. So anyway, I got to thinking, this is what we need, right? Like we need long studies. We need to look at multiple non-cognitive and academic outcomes and we need them tracked over time.
Interesting. And these kids, what kind of college did they go to?
They were about in the cash for college program, about half went to 2 year and half went to 4 year.
In California.
In California.
Probably mostly public.
Yes.
Okay. Public. There you go.
Yes.
I mean, I have so many questions, Amber. And I mean, so you mentioned
how it was a long study too.
You mentioned how compared to Pell Grant, but I do wonder like how much the total costs are. Mm-hmm. Like, are these still pretty small amounts compared to the total cost? And I assume that if these are low income kids, we're talking about they're taking out a bunch of loans for a big chunk. I mean, if you're going to a 4 year school, even with a Pell Grant, even with the scholarship, I don't know, you're probably still taking out some loans, maybe.
I would think you would be. Right. Yes.
And are they working? Do we know that?
We don't have any data on whether they're working.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, working less?
Well, no, on their self-reported data, they said they were basically expending more effort. Remember, they were kind of...
No, but working for pay, you mean
for
a
pay,
job.
I mean,
oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's where that 8 minutes comes from, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't think, at least they
didn't
report it.
Doubled my study time.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you on the methodology stuff, Amber, but I guess still the question is, so what does this mean? For example, on the free college question, you know, we're giving kids more money for college. I mean, it does sound like if you're going to do it, make it performance-based might be a good idea.
That's right. And oh, by the way, it costs less when it's performance-based, right? I mean, that's another thing that they didn't kind of get into at the end because you have fewer kids meeting those you know, performance-based criteria. So yeah, they're not paying out as much when you have that in place. So
you buy that, David?
That it costs less? Yes, definitely. I mean, I'm with you. Yeah, it's tough to know what to do with all this, right? I mean, I don't know.
I mean,
aren't we happy that kids are matriculating at higher rates when we continue to track them on the academic front? And they're concentrated with kids who have lower high school GPAs. So I didn't have time to say that.
Yes.
So there was some other good stuff, you know, for kids who, you know, we want to really be helping get over the hump.
It does sound good. And especially, you know, the fact that some of these lower dollar amounts seem to make a difference. It almost seems like a relatively inexpensive nudge.
Yeah, that's the question. Like, what is the mechanism?
Maybe it changes a little bit of the psychology. There's a, you know, loss aversion or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you're getting this money, it's going straight to the kid. You know, they call it a scholarship, but that could also just be called, you know, free spending money.
Mm-hmm. Well, also college is for you, right? Like, I mean, it's tough to unpack the financial and non-financial elements of this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it seems like, I don't know, the combination certainly helps.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, and there's no negative impact, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, sometimes, like, we have to think about that, right? Like, you kind of provide this incentive and then you take it away. Yeah. You know, are there sort of negative impacts on kids? And we didn't see that.
All right. So I think the takeaway then is forget.
I know where you're going with this.
Forget free college, right? What we need is just a small performance-based allowance
which for everybody. You then remove.
Yes, that Elizabeth Warren picks a billionaire, everybody's got a different billionaire who's like the rich uncle.
She picks all billionaires.
And they give a small performance-based allowance to these kids. That's all. There it is.
You solved it.
Oh my goodness. I think we all need a good break.
Big
for
turkey.
Thanksgiving.
Yes.
So let's go ahead and take it. That is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm David Griffin.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.